On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are going to be talking about teachers and discipline in the classrooms. This seems to be an issue. If you look at the numbers for Hamilton, a lot of suspensions the year before COVID. So what do you do about that? Well, someone who has written a piece about what teachers should do and what they can do, we'll talk to him. Also, Don Robertson joins us. Lots of stuff to get to for Don's Monday night usual weekly visit. We'll get into all of it. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
What do we do about students and classrooms right now at a time when it would seem that for teachers, maintaining discipline in the classroom has become more and more difficult? Because we don't necessarily want authority figures flexing their muscle. We don't necessarily want people to be telling us what to do or what not to do. It's a difficult time. These are not the old days in the schoolroom where a teacher could wrap you over the knuckles with a ruler. We are in very, very, very different times. But clearly, in order for kids to learn something, you have to have a classroom that has some order and some discipline. So how do you do this? There's a great piece in The Spec today. It is all about this very thing. It's by a guy named Michael Zweigstra. He is a high school teacher. He's an author. His books include A Sage on the Stage, Common Sense Reflections on Teaching and Learning, and What's Wrong with Our Schools and How We Can Fix Them. He joins us now. Michael, thanks for the time today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Scott. It's great to be with you.
This idea, and I'm glad you wrote this, because if nothing else, it makes us think, because this seems like such a conundrum in 2022. We seem to have less tolerance than ever before for bullying or disrespect or whatever. We don't want anyone to diss us or diss anyone else, but teachers, I would think, seem to have less power than ever to control what that is going on in their classroom. Is that a fair breakdown?
I would say in many cases it is, and the reality is that in many cases teachers are not in control of their classrooms. There's a lot of it that seems to be ceded or handed over to students. This idea of everything being student-centered to the point of the teacher supposed to be off the side and not just dictating to the class. And while I obviously believe there has to be some element of student voice and some flexibility, teachers clearly need to be in charge of their classroom. I mean, they are ultimately the ones who are responsible for the instruction that takes place.
The timing of your piece landing in The Spectator, now you're from out west, so you had no idea this was going to go in today, but there's a second piece in the paper from our school boards, and it was about the number of suspensions. Now, suspensions were way down in Hamilton last year, largely because kids weren't maybe generally in class because of COVID, but in 2019-20, there were 3,627 suspensions and 54 expulsions in public schools in Hamilton. I think that goes exactly to what you're saying here. There is a lot of stuff going on. And if you're a teacher and you don't take care of stuff, you're going to have some problems.
Well, absolutely. And and a lot of this just comes down to the teacher has to be clearly in control and right from the beginning. And I frankly wish that our faculties of education, which train teachers, would do a better job of helping teachers learn classroom management instead of pumping their heads full of all sorts of theories that in many cases don't work and have actually been discredited decades ago.
But the big question here is, do you believe that teachers think they have the backing of administration if they try to discipline a student? Because this is always going to be the thing. If you're a teacher and you discipline a kid, you'd better not have it taken away from you, or else those students then know forever that they've got you. But do you believe, if you're a teacher, that you're going to get that backing?
Well, it's obviously going to depend on the administration. And so obviously in some schools, administrators are more willing to back up teachers than others. I would suggest, though, that if a teacher knows how to take charge of their classroom, does so right from the beginning, you'll dramatically reduce any need to have administration backing you up. That doesn't mean that won't happen. There are still extreme cases, but far too often, what happens is you have teachers, particularly those that are new in their career, that are trying to be friends with their students or to be buddies with their students, and they start out really loose. And they're sort of off to the side trying to get students to co-write the rules with them. And that so often that just doesn't work. It's much harder to tighten up the reins later in the year than it is to loosen them by setting a clear, firm tone right from the beginning. So again, being clearly in charge won't deal with every discipline problem, and you do need administration backing in those cases, but it will address a lot of them.
Pardon my, this is not intended to be a pun. I was going to say it's an old school method or old time method. Isn't that kind of an old fashioned idea, though, that when you're a teacher, you coming in sort of flexing your academic muscles early on to show who's boss? That seems old.
Yeah, it's old, and it's but not everything that's old is bad. There are plenty of old things that work very well. What we should be considering is, is it effective? Is it worked? Is it supported by evidence? And the evidence is pretty clear that it is important for teachers to be in control. The teacher should be the most knowledgeable person in the room about the subject in hand. I always cringe when I hear statements by some teachers such as, "Oh, I learned more from the students than they learned from me." And my response to that is, well, then the wrong person is teaching the class then, if you're learning more than they are. You should be teaching them. You should be clearly in charge and instructing them. And so, yes, that may be old-fashioned in some ways, but old doesn't mean wrong. It just simply means it's been around for a while.
Michael, here's where, okay, so as I was reading this, I had the one thought that came to mind first for me was this. We know parents get involved now more than ever. I mean, if I got in trouble back when I was in school, actually, I shouldn't say if, that's assumed. When I got in trouble back in school, which happened a lot, I knew that when I got home, if the teacher had said Scott had screwed something up, my parents were, I was going to get it when I got home as well. I was going to get the stink eye. I was going to get grounded. I was going to get something. I'm not sure. I when my kids were in elementary school, we used to see parents coming in and fighting with the teachers about something the teacher was trying to do to correct or discipline their kid. How do you get around that? Because the schools don't seem to want to take on the parents.
In some cases they don't. But again, a lot of this comes down to the teacher being able to be firm and direct, and that includes with parents. I mean, I deal with parents too, and I find that most parents are actually quite reasonable. And for those who aren't, that just like any profession, sometimes you just have to say it like it is. I mean, whether you're a lawyer or a police officer or a doctor or a dentist or any profession, you're going to deal with people that will initially challenge you or won't agree with your assessment. And teachers have expertise, and we shouldn't be afraid to sort of be clear that, look, I do have some expertise here. I do know what I'm doing. And if you have that tone from the outset, not one where you're trying to sort of, because parents can tell when you're faking it or when you're overstating what your authority actually is, but most parents will respect a teacher who's well-established and knows what they're doing and is clear.
Let me read one line from the piece that you wrote. This is your words. I think it's fantastic. It's not to be insulting. It's not deep. It just really makes a ton of sense. And I think a lot of people would say the same thing. It's important. This is your quote. It's important to have clarity of roles. Teachers and students are to have separate roles, and we should not blur the distinction. That seems to happen an awful lot, doesn't it? And you've touched on it, that you helped me come up with the rules for this class. It should be entirely separate.
Of course. I always make the rules for my class. I actually don't have that many rules. I teach high school, and I don't really have that many rules, but I'm not interested in co-creating the rules with the class or co-creating curriculum or all these buzzwords that are going around. The teacher should be the one who's setting the rules. When I started teaching, I was quite young. I was in my early 20s, and I made a conscious choice that to dress professionally, even though the school didn't require it wasn't a very strict dress code. I chose to wear, a shirt and tie because I wanted to make it clear I'm not a student and I'm not going to blend in with students. And there has to be that clarity of distinction. The teachers and students are different roles, different things. We don't call pilots and passengers plane flyers. Like, that would be ridiculous. Like, you have one, you have an expert who's flying the plane. You have the people that are on the plane that's being flown. Doctors and patients aren't co-healers. We need to stop this blurring of the roles. They're very distinct.
The piece is called Teachers Must Retake Charge of Their Classrooms. The author is Michael Zweigstra, who has been joining us. Michael, thank you for the time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Always happy to do it.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let me bring in Don Robertson. It has been a while since we've had him here, but Don Robertson is the owner and operator of ComChoice Realty and of the Dundas Real McCoys and a variety of other things, and our vote for Dundas Citizen of the Year last year, this year, all years. We're going to just rename it the Don Robertson Award and just give it to you every year. That's one way to do it. Thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome, Scott. Your humor is wonderful. It's nice.
You know, nice with a large enough donation. Yeah, with a large enough donation, I'm sure it could be arranged.
Well, you know me, money talks. I'm not sure what happened. Look at the money.
Hey, we just had the Academy Awards, and, you know, those are all, they have giant promotions and lobbying efforts for each one of those movies, so why not for Dundas Citizen of the Year? Anyway.
Yeah, WWE was involved in the Academy Awards this year. It was fun to watch.
Yeah, no kidding. So, Don, we got a lot of stuff I want to get to this hour. It's a long list, but today is a rather important day in sports in this province because the new rules went into play that will allow single game betting. I don't think it's an overstatement to say the world of sports in Ontario changed today. People may or may not have noticed. If you're not into wagering, it went right by and you never noticed anything. But I got to tell you, I am of mixed opinion on whether ultimately this is going to be good or bad for sports. The good is, I suppose, that a lot more people, a lot more interested because they got money riding on stuff, and teams and organizations somehow getting into this and bringing more money into their coffers. The bad is, for the same reason, any kind of activity that is a vice gets introduced and expanded, we're going to have people with bigger problems. Where do you stand on this one?
Well, first of all, the government are not shy about taxing vices, cigarettes, alcohol, racing, horse racing in Ontario is a big business, has been for decades. It employs a lot of people, so it's a really big industry. You know, I have respect for the breeders and everybody that works in the business, but it's really not a surprise that the province, what surprises me is it took them so long. And you talk about people that may change and may become more interested in sports. The NFL, in part, if it weren't for pools, wouldn't have the popularity that they have. But, you know, when I look at it, it's another vice. They're not inventing it. They're not creating it. They're going to take advantage of it like they did with marijuana. And they're going to say, we just want our share. I think the people that bet, I don't know. What will be interesting to me, Scott, is, and they may have some studies, although I don't know how accurate they can be, but they'll have some idea about how many people in the province of Ontario were betting on offshore betting sites, on hockey, on anything that might be available to them. And quite frankly, I think the province just said, you know what, this thing is so popular, it's so big, all we want is our cut of the pie. So now the province is going to get a cut, and if it works out well, we can have better hospital care, and it'll put more money in their pockets. They'll fix our roads. They'll fix our hospitals. They'll take care of poor people. I don't know. I don't want to sound like a socialist, but the reality is it's been ongoing anyway. So why don't we get our pound of flesh?
Yeah. Maybe I'm a prude in some ways. My one concern with this is I think you're right about all of what you just said about how it's been going on and everything else. But as soon as a government endorses something, it essentially says, we don't think it's harmful. I think that's the interpretation that someone would get, that we don't think there's any problems with this. And I'm not, you know, just last hour, Don, we were talking, and I'm not in favor of more government intrusion into things in our lives. I don't want certain things. I don't want governments just banning stuff. The flip side of that, though, is, as I say, when a government says it's okay, it's almost a tacit approval that this thing is completely safe and completely harmless. We sort of expect the government wouldn't do anything to harm us or to allow us to be harmed. That's my only concern, is that it creates this sense that go ahead and doesn't matter who you are, what you are, what issues you have, it's fine. That's my concern of the government okaying of it.
There would be a lot of people that wouldn't share your opinion on the government not letting us do something if it wasn't okay. Because everybody's a critic of the government. It's a sport in Ontario. It's a sport in Hamilton. Go on Twitter. But one of the things that I look at when you look at this, again, I don't think it's going to create any new habits. And the thing I'd ask you, because I certainly don't know, I mean, I grew up in the 70s. I went to high school in the 70s. And it was pretty wild times back in the 70s. I never partook, but I'll tell you, lots of guys I know, like, drugs were pretty rampant. And now I look at the fact that marijuana is legal. And I think to draw a parallel to that comparison, I really have not noticed or don't believe that anybody in my circles, and, you know, I have stepkids that are in their 30s. I don't see it where it's changed one person that will now say, I think I'm going to smoke marijuana now because it's legal. I mean, the needle might have moved. It hasn't moved on my radar, and it hasn't moved in my immediate circle. So if you use the legalization of marijuana and compare it to sports betting, then the people that bet on sports are going to continue. I follow sports like you do. I have no burning desire to go out today and bet on a hockey game. So I don't know. I mean, if I use legalization of marijuana as a marker, I don't think it changes much other than the province might get some more tax dollars.
Yeah, no, the province will get more tax dollars and all the different organizations that are jumping into this. I mean, every league now wants a slice of theirs. And you know what? The flip side of this, Don, even, you know, arguing against myself here, I've long been of the opinion that user fees are not the worst thing in the world some places, sometimes. And this is essentially a user fee. And it's a tax that you are not obligated to pay. And so if you want to pay it, that's okay. So I know that's arguing against my own point, but rather than, you know, if this means that some other tax, because the government, heaven knows, every level of government is just swimming in debt. If they can cover some of that by having some of the people who want to do this voluntarily give it, and I don't have to have it added to my tax, okay. You know what? That's fine too.
Well, if everybody that's betting, Scott, now starts betting here locally, somebody was either making extra money by housing that offshore betting, or the countries where they were origin from were taxing it, then good for us. I mean, let's just take advantage of that opportunity, and maybe it'll backfill the free license plates. I don't know. I don't know if it'll create a lot of new bettors. And I can tell you one thing. The one I would use would be ScoreBet, because it originated from the Score, and the Score originated in Hamilton. So that's my choice. And I don't know anything about any of them, but that's my choice.
No, I'm not going to be a prude and say this should not happen. I'm not a gambler myself. But I have, on a few occasions, been in a pool or something else and put some money down. I would hate to think that, you know, someone would have come and pounded on the door and tried to arrest me for that. If you want to do that again, that's okay. I wonder how sports may or may not change going forward. I'll tell you one thing that I really hope is a positive that comes out of this, and I'm not holding my breath yet, but I think it may actually happen, Don. Because the NFL has been such a hotbed for gambling for decades now, they have their injured list, and it is an injured list that is adhered to and that is legitimate and is credible, because coaches are required. If a guy is hurt, you can't say, well, I don't know, he's a game time decision. And you can't say, well, it's a lower body injury. You know, Bob Smith is out for this game with a knee injury. And if this is going to take hold, hockey of all the sports is the one that does the most secretive work trying to keep things away from opponents. If one thing positive can come out of this, it's that the old Pat Quinn school of, you know, he's day to day with a lower body injury. Well, where do we find out the injury was? Well, it was his collarbone, but that was lower than his ear. So it was lower body. I mean, maybe we get information out of the coaches and teams now that we didn't get before, because that would be a positive thing.
Yeah, it's amazing that they let that type of stuff go on. And as soon as one team does it, then they all do it.
Of course.
And it's always amazing when they talk about, when you reference hockey, well, it's a lower body injury. Well, we just saw a knee-on-knee hit. You think it's his ankle? Right, but they, you're right. That would be a wonderful side effect.
If that's the one thing we get out of this, that would be a positive for the world of sports and for other people who wish to gamble. You know what? I mean, look, that's your choice. That we allow people to do stuff and to make decisions for themselves. So, you know, that's where we are. Maybe we can find maybe this will spill into some positive things for sports. And we can certainly hope so. We can certainly hope so. And here's one other one that will not happen. Okay. If that's the positive that we think might happen, here's the positive that could happen, Don, but in a trillion years will never happen. And that is, if the teams in the leagues now get into this, maybe they would say, hey, we've now made X million dollars a year on wagering. We can drop the ticket prices so an average family could go and watch a game once in a while. I mean, it'll never happen, but it's a nice thought.
I never contemplated ever once that you would take advantage of the legal marijuana in Ontario, but I'm a little skeptical now. If you're actually thinking that,
No, I said it'll never happen, but it's the dream. Okay. It's the dream, but you know it will never happen. It will never happen. The day that Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment says, you know what, folks, we've really taken a lot of money from you. So this year coming up, we're going back to 1979 prices and gold seats are $35. Don, last night, Kyle Lowry with the Miami Heat came back to Toronto, and the Toronto fans and the Raptors feted him, I think, appropriately. They were very enthusiastic, and, you know, he's arguably the greatest player in Raptors history, so he got the full video tribute and got the standing O, and everyone chanted his name and all the rest. It was great. But I wonder this. We have seen now, that being the one end, we've also seen, though, guys come back to their teams where they played for a couple years maybe and get video tributes. Where's the bar? Where's the line? What should you have had to do for a franchise that when you come back to that city, they stop the game and put on a video tribute for you? Because to me, it seems like it's gone, not the Lowry one, that was very appropriate, but for some of these, they've become ludicrous.
Well, I think longevity and contribution are pretty big parts of that. You can't argue about Kyle Lowry's contribution to the Toronto Raptors and not just the championship year. I mean, he was a star, and he had an interesting journey. I mean, he came here, there was controversy, they were going to trade him, and I don't, you know, I think he probably enjoyed every little bit of it. The fans absolutely loved it. So the comparison I would draw is that you have him. Oh, I just drew a blank. Who's the guy they brought in for the 1 year to win the championship?
Oh, I'm drawing a blank.
Okay, so anyways.
Yeah, thank you. It's Monday evening. I've just completely gone blank.
Yeah, so you know who I mean.
Kawhi Leonard.
Kawhi Leonard, yes.
Yeah.
So everybody uses somebody. The Raptors used him, right? So you bring a guy in, he helps you do something very significant. Does he deserve that? No, not on a bet. I mean, they may give him one. But really the guys that do deserve it is Kyle Lowry, who was an integral part for a long time of the franchise. The thing that always escapes me, and I guess I've just never been a loyal enough fan to anybody, is Kyle Lowry wanted to leave. He wasn't cut. He wasn't traded because they didn't want him anymore. He chose to leave. And I always think that diminishes sometimes your legacy. It doesn't seem to in sports much. Daryl Sittler ripped the C off his sweater, wanted out, right? I mean, there's all kinds of different examples that you can look at where guys wanted to leave. But when Lowry, I mean, he really became Kyle Lowry, which is a ridiculous statement.
No, I know what you mean, though.
Toronto, and made tremendous contributions and probably was very well deserving. But I never forget the fact that the year after they won, he wanted to leave.
Well, and the thing, you know, the example of Daryl Sittler, that's a really interesting one because I think that Sittler got away with what he did and it never hurt him at all, is that every single fan was on his side and thought Harold Ballard was a giant buffoon who was causing it. And so, you know, you got away with that one. I mean, another one, Robbie Alomar, who wanted out, you know, after a few years. Now Robbie Alomar has now got different problems that will prevent him from coming back to the Jays. But it's just, you know, we've seen guys come back to a town where they played for a couple of years. There was a famous example 4 or 5 years ago with the Boston Celtics where there was a guy, I can't think who it was, who there was a huge dispute because he thought he deserved a video tribute. And the team says, no, not only did you play here for 2 years, but we've got another tribute for another player coming back that same day. So you're not getting a video tribute. And he was outraged. So I find the whole thing
then that guy's an idiot.
Agreed.
Kawhi Leonard, you can give him a video, and I don't remember if he's been back. He has been back. I don't know.
He did. And they gave him one.
Yeah, but, you know, make that one like half an inch long. Make Kyle Lowry's a foot long, right? I mean, that's a big deal. He built himself. He did a lot of wonderful things here. But always keep it into perspective. Like, Dougie Gilmore was not here forever. But boy, did he make an impact for like 3 or 4 years, right? He deserves everything he gets. But every organization, and the Raptors are the same as the Leafs, don't always conduct themselves with consistency, right? Like, let me use Rick Five as an example. Scored 53 times, was the captain. The Leafs aren't doing anything that I'm aware of. Regarding having him be a part of Austin Matthews breaking his record. So sometimes organizations pick and choose for their own reasons. So you have to kind of judge them on their whole scope of work. I know we're jumping from basketball to hockey, but MLS.
No, but it's the same idea. It wasn't restricted to basketball. The question was, what should you have to do? Or what's the bar that you should be getting one of these things? Because I think a lot of these have become ludicrous. A lot of them have become almost rote that you have to, it's expected that if someone comes back after a couple of years, they'll get a tribute. And it seems stupid. I mean, like, here's another example with Zach Hyman. I like Zach Hyman. He played for the Hamilton Red Wings. He's a nice guy. You know, I know his brother. I've met his brothers. I've talked to his brothers. The whole deal. Should Zach Hyman get a video tribute when he came back to Toronto? Now, there was nobody in the building. But is Zach Hyman of the level or whatever that a video tribute is an appropriate thing when you return? I don't know the answer to that, but I would say he was a loved player here. But that would seem to be the bottom end of what the barometer might be.
Well, I, rather than pass an opinion on Zach Hyman, I will offer a slight one. He's no Kyle Lowry.
No, Lowry's an easy one.
That's why we're talking about it. See, the age has changed, right? times have changed. In the old days, if you played for the Leafs, and I'm talking old days like the 70s or anything, let me bring up Rick Vive again. When he came back, the fans would determine the tribute, right? They would say standing ovation or whatever, because they didn't do tributes then. Now it's all sizzle and everything else. And to drop the bar, to use your term, he would be near the bottom of someone that perhaps should have a video tribute. So does that diminish if a legend comes back? Like, it's like putting numbers and sweaters in the rafters. I know we're not the biggest deal in the world, the Dundas Real McCoys. We've retired one number. Larry Rutschen passed away of cancer as an active member of the Dundas Real McCoys. Nobody will ever wear 28 again. We've honored Mark Juris. We've honored Rick Vive, actually. We've honored a number of players. But so I think you pick and choose and you try and do it properly. That's our version of doing it properly, but perhaps it's nobody else's. But there's always different scales. And when you start handing them out, like they're small chocolate bars at Halloween, they become less significant.
Yeah, perfect way to end it. I agree wholeheartedly that they become less significant. You're right. You're 100% right. Don, we have heard through the day today some erroneous rumors or reports. Mike Bossy is not doing well. He's got lung cancer. That's public. At one point today, we heard he had passed away. Turns out not to be true. Another point, we heard he'd gone into palliative care. That also appears not to be true. He is still, according to the last thing I saw, still at home battling this. Either way, he's having a tough go. Who for you, and Mike Bossy may be the answer, but who for you is the greatest pure goal scorer in NHL history?
Brett Hull.
Why?
Well, I don't know. It's going to be a quiz after.
But what is it about Brett Hull that's ahead of Bossy or ahead of Lemieux or ahead of Rocket Richard or ahead of Wayne Gretzky or whomever?
I don't know.
Or Ovechkin.
For an answer, I'm trying to be entertaining. I don't know. I mean, they're all different in their own right. Mike Bossy clearly was one of the very elite. And I don't really think that you can break them all down. There would be lots of arguments that Matthews is right now, but that's because he's on TV and he's doing it in the present. You could make an argument that the only guy that ever scored 92 was maybe the best pure goal scorer of all time, but nobody ever talks about him. Gretzky is never brought up as one of the greatest goal scorers of all time, and yet he's the only guy that ever scored 92 goals. So, but he's never in the conversation. I think I'm partial to Brett Hull is because he came to a couple practices with the Brantford Ponce Tomatoes and his brothers played, and his dad was always around, and probably it's more personal than real because I don't know if you can categorize them. Like, I would never picture Gretzky as a pure sniper, but you can't diminish the fact he scored 92 goals and nobody else ever did. Now, Hull scored 86 one year. Team Mussolini isn't often brought up. But I think for a consistent basis on championship teams, Mike Bossy is clearly in the top five. And I defy anybody to figure out who's the absolute best. Ovechkin is. See, Ovechkin's playing in an era when lots of people don't score 50 goals. And he consistently does big numbers, right? The game is different than it was in the 80s when Gretzky and Lemieux were doing it, and to a certain extent, Hull. So I guess if you really want to get an argument when things were a lot tighter, you would talk about Rocket Richard and Brett Hull's dad.
Because yeah, and boom, Jeffrey on back then, who got 50 and 50. I mean, look, okay, so let me ask you. You mentioned Ovechkin for a second. I'm going to ask you a question. You've coached a lot of hockey over your life. Alex Ovechkin has whatever now, 700 and whatever goals, and a huge percentage of them are from the same spot, setting up at the top of the circle and firing it from there. If you were coaching against him, I would bet money, and I just last hour, just earlier this hour, we talked about how I don't bet. I would make an exception to say, you knowing that he's got hundreds of goals from that same spot, you would not allow him to stand there by himself and would have someone just covering him or doing something. How has Alex Ovechkin been able to score from the same place for so many years without anybody doing something to take that shot away from him?
Well, I know how to take a shot away from him. I two-hand him on the forearms and break both his forearms, and you'd be done. But that would only be in the playoffs because it would be unfair to do it in the regular season. But let me tell you, Brett Hull did something very similar back to Brett Hull. He would stand at the top of the face-off circle, and as a coach, pre-game, you're going, so here's where Ovechkin's going to be. Everybody in the building knows. Everybody on their team knows. Everybody on our team knows. You can't let them get there alone. And those guys have a knack of being, like, you have to watch the film. You have to watch the video. Watch how he does it. And all of a sudden, the guy appears there. And his ability to shoot the puck and his teammates to find him in a split second, it looks like in the highlights, Scott, that he's been standing there, you know, whistling the theme song of Andy and Mayberry, and nobody's paying any attention to him. The reality is he just scoots there, and all the timing is almost perfect. The defenseman turns around. The forward who should be down low turns around and goes, how does that happen? Because it's split second. It looks very obvious to you and I, but you can't prevent it.
Here's what I would do, Don. And I honestly, I don't know why this has never happened. In basketball, there are teams that will play the box and one. If you've got a superstar player on the other team, you'll play a zone defense and you'll have one person guard someone man-to-man. I don't understand. I really don't. I don't understand why teams have not decided that we're going to have someone on Ovechkin when they're set up in our end and just stand in front of him wherever he goes and don't. These guys are good enough defenders that if you had someone whose job it was to follow Ovechkin, they could take away that pass 9 times out of 10.
So Mark Juris was maybe clearly was the most premier goal scorer and point getter in our level of hockey and in Europe. I saw one night, you know, this guy, Bradley, I don't care. If Mark Juris goes to the bathroom, you're going with him. You've heard that old story.
Yep.
So they put a guy on him. Put a guy on him. It's a lot of fun. He's so clever. So smart, right? He goes and stands beside one of their defensemen. Now there's three of them there. Now it's a 4-on-3. Those guys that are that good or that smart, right? Like we could beat teams 4-on-3. He's not going to do anything. But he's got two of their guys tied up. He's following one of their guys around now. So you're right. If it was that easy, there's a lot of guys making $1 million a year coaching in the NHL that know Ovechkin's going to shoot from there, and they can't prevent it. But I'm explaining to you, this is how it happens. He is so good, so quick. He spins off somebody. Watch his goals. He'll roll off a guy that's checking him, end up in that spot for a split second, and his guys know they're going to be there. And the puck's in the net, and there's like four guys sitting there going, are you kidding me? He did it again? Like, if it was as simple as you said, they'd shut him down, and you can't. And he's a big man.
Like, he's not a big guy. He's a lot bigger than people give credit for. He's a big guy.
He's not Mitch Marner up there. Like, he is.
No.
He's a big galoot.
So just back to the question where we started this about who's the best goal scorer, best pure goal scorer in the NHL, and Mike Bossy, where this started, because he's not doing well, we hear right now. I would listen, everyone who watched Mike Bossy, and I did, that was my youth watching that era of Islanders. I mean, Mike Bossy was amazing. Here's the thing that is so amazing to me, Don, is how much when we have these discussions that we somehow, and not just you, not just me, everybody, how we somehow turn this into a legitimate discussion when there can be no discussion. That year, 1981-82, Mike Bossy scored 64 goals. That was his third highest total of his career. He had 69 one year, he had 68 one year, he had 64 one year. 64 goals. That's a remarkable year. Gretzky had 92 that year. Gretzky was almost half again as many as a guy who was considered the premier goal scorer of his generation. These discussions, it always amazes me. We make these discussions and we try to find ways to somehow explain away Wayne Gretzky. And every single time you break it down, you can't get away from the fact that it's not even a discussion. I mean, the numbers that he put up are otherworldly. And even if you say, well, it was an easier time to score then, sure it was. But he still got 50% more than the next highest guy. Like every argument about hockey, about who's the best at this, it's always, you always end up coming back to Wayne Gretzky. Always.
I'm going to go on the limb and think I said that. Right?
Yep.
He's almost always never in that conversation. But he scored 92. After, the year before, I don't know how well you remember this. The year before, everybody said, well, he picks up this assist and that assist, and, you know, he's not really a goal scorer. Next year, he goes out and scores 92. Kind of like, here, hold my beer and watch.
Yep.
Then he scores 92.
So, to make that comparison, is he ever
in the conversation of best purest goal scorer?
No, not never, very often. Never. But to make the comparison, so Austin Matthews this year has 51. And is having a year, an unbelievable season. Wayne Gretzky this year would finish with 75. Even if you want to deflate it for scoring inflation or whatever else. I mean, it's the problem here with anything you do to try and say, well, it's not Gretzky, is that it's not the era he played in. Yes, he played in a more wide open era, but the numbers he put up were always so far ahead of his contemporaries that it doesn't matter what the numbers were. The only way to compare someone, the only gauge is how did you do compared to the other guys who were playing at the same time as you? And he was 50% higher than the next best guy who's considered one of the all-time greatest ever. It's crazy.
Here's what I think. If Wayne Gretzky was 27 years old right now and he played in the NHL, he'd be the best player. No, I'm gonna call you out on something. Because you said if Wayne Gretzky played this year, he'd score 75. I don't think he would have. He's 60 years old, Scott.
Yeah, true enough. True enough. No, well done. I don't even know where to go from there. Yes, well, true enough. He might be a little slower.
Right?
But that the 50%, you can only compare against your contemporaries, and if he's 50% higher, he would have been a 75-goal scorer right now. So he didn't get 92 if he was playing today, but if you got 75 in 2022, you'd still be pretty darn good.
Don Cherry always points out that Bobby Orr one year was a plus 127. And for those that don't know, that means he was on 5-on-5, not power play, not penalty kill, but even strength, he was on for 127 goals more than he was on for against. And Bobby Orr, Wayne Gretzky, all those guys, you know what? They're phenomenal players to play in this league right now, any way you want to play it. That's how good they are.
And there were players on the ice against him. It wasn't like he got to do it for free. Anyway, Don, I just looked at the clock. Yeah. I'm way past time. Really appreciate the time today. Thanks for doing this, as always.
I'm going to tell you, though, you better come to Greitmeyer. The Dundas Real McCoys and Hamilton Steelhawks are playing for the Robertson Cup this Friday and Sunday in Dundas.
There you go. Good plug. Appreciate it. We'll remind people again later in the week. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.